It's always a danger in preaching familiar passages that familiarity breeds contempt or at least carelessness. And it's been interesting for me personally to go back through this passage again this week and try to see it through fresh eyes. And I hope that not that I would be burdened or committed to novelty, but that you might see this with fresh eyes yourself this morning. So coming to the passage this morning, I have a question, as I often do, and I want to frame your thinking along this line. What does it take to train someone to be an effective and fruitful disciple of Jesus Christ? What does it take for someone to really be useful and fruitful in the Lord's work? In our modern world, we tend to focus on technique, the skills necessary to succeed in ministry, to do our ministries effectively. And so we have seminars. How to. And then we have follow-up seminars on evaluation and improvement. And then we have people write books and say, this is the way I did it. Imitate me. Do it my way. But you know what I find out? When we're done with all the seminars and all the books and all the videos, we still doubt our ability to make a difference. And I've been with you for a long time, so forgive me for things that I notice that maybe someone else doesn't, but I noticed that we have had seminars on evangelism and discipleship on at least 7 occasions that I can remember with 7 different teachers, and I still have somebody say to me, Pastor, nobody ever showed me how. That's really not the issue, I think, in the most part. You see, as we look at the preparation of the disciples to become apostles, in other words, to go from people who just followed Jesus to people who went out in the world and proclaimed Him to the entire world, one of the things that is strikingly lacking is how-to training. You know, we have these things, we look at it, and you find that Jesus does this, and He does that, and it's really tough to pick up a pattern that says, this is how you do this and thus and so. Yes, the disciples ministered alongside Jesus and were sent out on missions of their own, but the how-to is not what they seem to come away with as the central thrust. And I'm convinced from studying the Gospels, that they are not focused on how, but who. And in our lack of fruit, Jesus said, is not a lack of technique, but apart from me, you can do nothing. It's about who. Who is this guy, and what is he, and how in the world can I become successful in my calling to serve Him? And this is what's going on in chapters 14 to 17 of Matthew and the training of the disciples as Jesus takes them through a number of situations that they could learn about Him. Culminating in chapter 17 with the transfiguration. Okay, guys, you're finally ready to see me with the curtains drawn, pulled apart in all my glory, but you're not getting it yet. And so as you look at these, as the opposition starts to mount, Jesus takes His disciples and says, guys, let me let you see who I am. And last week we saw this in the feeding of the 5,000. Guys, it's very simple. Go feed them. Hey, what? It costs. Look how much money it costs. Look at this. Just tell them to sit down. You come to me, and then you go to them. And then you come to me, and then you go to them. And you come to me, and you go to them. And you'll find out real quickly, because of me, there's more than what you need, not less. Did you catch that from last week? And so following up on that, we're in a story now that is going on as Jesus is teaching them. It's not really about how skilled you are, but by how much you trust me. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the chief threat to our fruitfulness as disciples is doubt. It's doubt. Now, I'm not talking about a mindless confidence and certainty. There's a certain surgeon in town, I think, that has retired, but he used to have a sign on his office wall that said, usually right, occasionally wrong, never in doubt. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about your confidence in yourself. I'm talking about your confidence in the Lord. Because the focus in the Gospels is on faith, a faith built on obedience to Christ, who then makes us sufficient to feed 5,000, who makes us sufficient to reach the world, who makes us sufficient to do whatever He's commanded us to do. And one of the main reasons we doubt is we try to do what He's commanded us to do in our strength, and He says to me, you and me both, I never asked you to do anything you could do on your own. I've commanded you to do that which only I can do through you. And so, we want to look this morning, this incident, I want to share with you three reasons that we doubt and therefore don't do. And they are in the bulletin. If you missed it last week, there wasn't one, but this week there is. The first is very simple. You doubt because you seem to be on your own. You seem to be on your own. One of the tremendous garden beds of doubt is the ordinary, everyday things that we do. See, in verse 22, Jesus immediately made His disciples get into the boat and go before Him to the other side. That's no big deal. Most of these guys were fishermen. They spent their whole lives on the Sea of Galilee. They've been in the boat many times. You guys get in the boat, go over to the other side, and so they get in the boat and they start rowing. Hey, no problem. What do you do for a living? Well, for years, I've just rowed. What are you doing now? Rowing. Just rowing. Rowing. Let's row. It's no problem. Back to normal. Back to the ordinary. Back to the future for some people. But then, while we're doing our thing, Jesus does His thing. Verse 23. And when He had sent the multitudes away, He went up on the mountain by Himself to pray. Now, when the evening came, He was alone there. You see, one of the striking things about Jesus is when He gets some time to Himself, what does He do? He prays. What do we do? Start the list, right? Watch television, read a book, talk to a friend, call somebody, get on Facebook, get on, you know, I finally got some time to myself. Let me spend it with somebody else. Isn't it kind of bizarre that God walking in the flesh felt the need to pray every opportunity He got, and we don't? Why is that? Because I'm out here rowing, man. I'm just doing my thing. I'm rowing. I row. I think one of the reasons is that He has higher goals for us than we have for ourselves. We love the ordinary. We love the mundane. We love things just stay where they are. We don't want the boat rocked. Isn't that the worst thing you can do to a boat? Rock it? But why does Jesus pray? Well, right now, in heaven, here's what it says in Hebrews 7:25. Therefore, He's able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through Him, since He always lives to make intercession for them. Underline those words, to the uttermost. There are all too many people who want to be saved at most. The most I want is to have heaven. And then after that, I just want to row. Just let me row. Leave me alone, Lord. Don't ask me to do anything great. Just let me row. I can row. I can handle this. I've always rowed. I know how to row. And He's praying. And what's He praying for? He's praying that you and I become this tremendous trophy of grace. A phenomenal witness of that which only God can do. And that's why He prays and we don't. Because we think, if I've got a good paycheck, and I've got a comfortable house, and my family's doing okay, I really have no needs. And God says, what I want you to desire, passionately desire, is to be fully formed into the character of Jesus Christ. You say, I can't do that. God says, exactly. Why don't you start praying? But that's what Jesus does, and here's what we do. We row. And we get stuck in this. And the thing is that here's the other part of this whole thing of doubt, is then life gets hard. Look at verse 24. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, and the wind was contrary. That's one way of putting it. Another way to translate it is the wind was just obtuse. It was just against them, fighting against them. And so it's hard. What do you do when life gets hard? Here's the absolute normal human response. Row harder. Row harder. He said, oh, not me. Oh, no, wait a minute. Wait just a minute. Watch this process. Hey, did you spend any time in prayer today? Oh, man, I need to, but you know, I am so busy. Things are so tough right now. I've got to work overtime. I've got to do this. I've got so much I have to do. Row, row, row your boat. You do too. When life gets hard, all we tend to do is row harder. And get where? Nowhere. Apart from me, you can do nothing. They haven't learned this lesson yet. One of the primary reasons that we doubt is it seems like we're on our own, and on our own we say, I'm doing all we can, it doesn't get any better than this, of course life's hard, nothing's going to ever happen because this is ordinary, and I'm ordinary, and I'm staying ordinary. Row. And so you doubt. There's another component, however, that combines with this that really ups the doubt level. You also doubt because Jesus is unpredictable. Jesus is unpredictable. I'm sorry, I already had that one. Jesus is unpredictable. Next one. He doesn't do what you expect. He is Lord. He is Lord. That's the challenge. Now here's something that kind of gets lost in this story. When Jesus is telling the disciples, get in the boat and row over there, and he's telling the other people, you go home, what he is doing is exercising his lordship because everyone knew what needed to be done after feeding the 5,000. It's just that Jesus disagreed. This is one of the problems, by the way, with an inherent belief in taking a vote. It would have been 5,012-1, but since the one was Jesus, he wins. You see, in John 6:15, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. This is a showdown of lordship. You guys think it's time to take force and take me to the cross, to the crown, just like the triumphal entry. Get all excited, go tell everybody that Jesus Christ is king. And he says, tell them that I'm the suffering Savior too. No, that doesn't sell. But you see, they were all ready to do this. And this is their mindset. And the disciples were right in there with it. You say, how do you know that? Turn over to chapter 16, will you? Just one page over in my Bible. Chapter 16, verse 21. Matthew 16:21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. And then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord. Don't you love the way we call Jesus Lord while we're telling him he's wrong? This shall not happen to you. And so Jesus said, oh, thank you, Peter. I lost my head. No, get behind me, Satan. You see, there's this mindset that he's not doing what we expect. He's doing what he planned. And very often, Jesus is doing things that we don't know about. And when we do know about him, sometimes we don't understand. But remember this one thing, he is Lord. That means absolutely sovereign. C.S. Lewis tried to capture this in the Narnia series, where he had the characters on some time to time look at each other and saying, what's Aslan going to do? I don't know, he's not a tame lion. I don't have a leash on him. You'd be amazed how many people think they got a leash on God. Here's how God works. This is the only way God works. And if this isn't the way God's working, then God isn't working. But you know what? One of the ways you can tell you're really walking with Jesus is every once in a while you're scared to death. You say, what? Yeah. You see, you look at this. Look at verse 26. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it's a ghost! And they cried out with fear. Can I say something to you about this story that you may not have noticed? We tend to superimpose on this story a previous event when Jesus was in the boat with them and the storm was so bad it was sinking. And they were terrified of the storm. There is no word of fear this time around of the wind and the waves. In fact, it isn't even described as a storm. It's just saying the wind's out of the west, it's fighting against them as they try to row across, and there are waves. What are they afraid of? Jesus. Wait, that's not... Whatever their mindset of life, it couldn't work for them because they're looking at it and saying, this is not the way anybody does this, including Jesus. And I sympathize because, you know, over in John chapter 6, verse 19, when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking. Kid, think about that. I said, no, last night, it takes you 6-7 hours to row 3 or 4 miles. How long does it take to walk it? Isn't that kind of weird, you know? It doesn't fit. I can remember as a junior higher reading Popular Mechanics, you know, back there when it came on stone tablets. And I remember reading about this guy that had patented a design for water walking shoes. And what they were really about 5-foot canoes that strapped on each foot. And if you had incredible balance and everything else, and you didn't mind getting nowhere fast, you could walk on water. It doesn't work that way. And we look at Christ sometimes, and we see what he's doing, and say, no, not that way. Forgive me, some of you feel that way about this. No, Jesus, you can't work that way. No guitars. We know how you work. It's organs only. And you know what happens when we start to see Jesus work in ways that we didn't anticipate? We get scared. And we need to hear Paul writing to Timothy, for God has not given you a spirit of fear, but of power, that means ability, and of love, and of a sound mind. See, here's the challenge to you and to me. They're now afraid not of a storm, but of Jesus. And I want to underscore to you that faith is not believing that God will do what I want, what I like, what I prefer, and what makes me happy. Faith is believing that God will be God, and that I get to join in with Him as He does. That God will do what only God can do. And every once in a while, He's going to sneak up on me because He's accomplishing His purposes. He's not asking my permission. That's hard, my friend. Because along with the mundane, there's another aspect that breeds doubt. It's called uncertainty. We're incredibly struggle when we're not quite sure what's going on. There was a Dutch study that I kind of laughed reading about. They took a group of subjects, and they really did this, by the way, to them, but they sat down the first group of subjects, and they hooked them up to electrodes. And they said, okay, we're going to shock you 20 times in a row. Okay? And it's not going to be comfortable, but just get yourself ready. The people thought the shock was the test. The test was how much their heart rate and breathing increased when they got told this. And how much your perspiration changed. Then they took a second group. And they said this, we're going to shock you 20 times. 17 of them are going to be very mild. And 3 of them are going to be very strong. Guess which group sweated more? Their heart rate went higher. Their breathing increased the most. Not the people who got shocked hard 20 times, but the people who got shocked 20 times, 17 times softly and only 3 times hard because the apprehension of when the hard ones were coming. Just made them with everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, uncertainty drives us to doubt. But you know what the thing about doubt is? God doesn't change. I love Acts chapter 12 because it starts off with Herod grabbing James and killing him. And then he sees that it works all right in the political polls. Nobody's upset. They're even kind of saying, hey, that's pretty good. We're kind of tired of this guy preaching all the time. And so he grabs Peter and he throws him in prison. And the expectation is the next day, Peter's dead. In the middle of the night, an angel comes, takes Peter out of the prison. You remember the story, don't you? Where does he take him? To prayer meeting. Where they're praying for what? Peter. He knocks on the door. A servant girl comes and she knows not to unlock the door to strangers. She opens a little thing. It's Peter! And like a little girl might do, she's all excited. She doesn't open the door. She runs in and tells everybody, it's Peter! It's Peter! It's at the door! And everybody said, oh, thank God, we've been praying for that. If you ever think that it's the amount of faith that you have that determines what God does, read the Bible, okay? These people had no expectation that Peter was going to be at the door that night. But you know what they said? In Acts 12:15, they said to her, "You are beside yourself," yet she kept insisting that it was so. So they said, "It is his angel." To me, that's just like the disciples in the boat. It's a ghost. It can't be what it obviously is. And so I don't know what to do with it. And so let's talk about fables. Because, ladies and gentlemen, we doubt. Because it's unpredictable. And God does God things. You spend a lot of your life doubting because you're just busy rolling. And that just can't be the way God works. You doubt because you seem to be on your own. You doubt because Jesus is unpredictable. And third, you doubt because you forget what you already know. The person who has never walked with Jesus doesn't doubt nearly as much as the person who's tried. Okay? Can I comfort you with that? If you struggle with doubts, cool. You know why? Because the reason you struggle with doubts is because you've kind of gotten there and gotten started down a path, and now it's not quite working the way you expected. And forgive me, but I think that's pretty neat. I love it when my kids come back and say, "Dad, what about this?" Okay, let's work our way through this because that's part of growth. And when you forget what you already know, you have to go through a relearning process with the Lord. And follow me as quickly as I can in running through this relearning process, okay? The relearning process goes like this. Number one, you know you can trust Jesus. I mean, that's the bottom line. If I asked anybody here, if we took a survey, can you trust Jesus? Everybody, oh, yes, check that one off, man. And how do you know that? Well, a lot of times it's because you've been here before. And the disciples had. Turn back just a couple pages to Matthew chapter 8. About four pages back in my Bible, in verse 23. Matthew chapter 8, verse 23. "Now when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep." You know, Jesus just doesn't get it. Here you're supposed to be afraid. Chapter 14, you're supposed to be rowing. Here he is sleeping and walking. "Then his disciples came to him and woke him, saying, 'Lord, save us, we're perishing.' And he said to them, 'Why are you fearful, O you little faith?'" Does that sound familiar? "Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, 'Who can this be, that even the winds and the sea obey him?'" They haven't figured it out by chapter 14 yet. They're still figuring this out. Who is this guy? But they know from experience they can trust him. There's a couple of things in verses 27 and 28 of chapter 14 that I want you to note, though. 27, "Immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid.'" That's good English, but I think it masks something. When he says, "It is I," in Greek, okay, you got to have this. I got to show you that I got my money's worth from seminary, all right? The words are, "ego eimi." Now, you could say, "It is I," by just saying, "a me." It's the word, that word by itself means, "It is I," or it means, "I am." When you add "ego," it is, "I am. I myself am." Is anybody getting ahead of me now, or where this is going? See, when they translated the interchange between Moses and God in the Septuagint, and Moses said, "Who shall I say has sent me?" God said, "I am. Just tell them I am has sent you." And Jesus would say to the Pharisees, "Before Abraham was, I am." And if you want to really appreciate the Gospel of John, read through it, and every time you come across the words, underline them, "I am." I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am. I am. I am. This is at least a veiled reference. I'm your God, guys. It's me. You don't recognize it. You don't see my hand at work because you think you're supposed to just tell us to row. God's here. And there's another part to this that I think is really neat. In the Old Testament, you got a whole bunch of water stuff that people do, you know? Moses turned the Nile into blood, and Moses parted the Red Sea, and Joshua stopped the Jordan. And, you know, then with Elijah and Elisha, you got the axe head floating. You got all kinds of water stuff. But there was one thing in the Old Testament that was reserved for God alone. And Job reflected that in Job 9:8. He alone spreads out the heavens, and He alone treads on the waves of the sea. Guys, I am. I am. It ain't about rowing and it ain't about the boat. I am. I'm right here. You can trust me. And you've learned that before, but you've forgotten. Because what happens often is that our initial trust leads to a trial, as in a trial run. Okay? We call it living by faith, and we really mean, let me just try doing it God's way and see if it works. Okay? We'll just give this baby a little run with the training wheels on here, and we go out there, and we'll test God. In verse 29... Or 28, Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. And so he said, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. And one more time, if you ever think about getting down on Peter in this whole story, please don't. There were 11 other guys sitting in the boat going, I can't believe he's doing that. You know, in Christian circles today, by the way, it's a big thing to talk about thinking outside the box. Christians don't need to think outside the box. They got to get out of the boat. They got to walk outside the boat. Get out of the ordinary, right? The way we always done things and the way we always do things. And let's get out there and just go to Jesus. And so Peter gives it a trial run. You say, how do you know it's a trial run? Because the minute that he perceived a trial, he lost his focus. Verse 30. But when he saw the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out, Lord, save me. It's a matter of focus. If it's you, Lord, you speak the word, here I come. Come on out. Okay. And all of a sudden he's out of the boat and somebody hits him. I'm out of the boat. One of the amazing things about walking with Jesus and seeing God be faithful is that you can't ever see exactly how he does it. That's a tension point in the Christian life. On the one hand, you don't want to be presumptuous. On the other hand, you don't want to be faithless. You don't want to say, God, you got to do something really weird because I want you to do something really weird here. On the other hand, you can't look at God and say, you can't do that. Don't you know it's impossible, God? With man, it is impossible. With God, all things are possible. And so he gets out of the boat and he's out there and Jimmy Johnson was a coach of the Dallas Cowboys. They're headed to the Super Bowl. The day of the Super Bowl, he's got to give them a talk in the locker room. And he has them bring in this big, long 2x4, and it lays it right down in the middle of the locker room. He says, guys, I want you to understand something. And if I tell you right now, I want you to walk this 2x4 from that end of the locker room to this end of the locker room, every one of you can do it. He says, but if I take that same 2x4 and I put it between two buildings 20 stories up, the vast majority of you won't even try, and the majority of those who try will fail. It's the same 2x4. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a Lord who's taking us out there and saying, guys, it's not that you can't in my power, but did you look at everything else instead of me? I don't know how many times I've had somebody that was doing something sit down with me and say, Pastor, I don't think I can do this. Now, wait a minute. Why do you doubt that you can do what you're doing? You follow me? How often we're in the middle of it and we're handling it and God's being faithful and it's hard, man. And nothing's changed in my circumstances, but God is still being faithful. And I start looking at my circumstances and say, I can't do this. You're right, you can't, but you are. Is God good or what? You are. I don't know how many books out there, Christian and secular, have come into people's lives and explained to them why they can't be faithful in the situation that they're in. Because look at all the circumstances, and people come back and say, oh, Pastor, I was being faithful to my wife. I was doing this. I was being faithful to my husband. I was doing this thing and that thing. And then I read this book, and I suddenly realized it's not fair, and it's hard, and it's just too much for me. Burn the book. Please. When you're walking on water, don't let anything convince you can't. Just because you can't explain it. You say, well, Peter's faith failed. Actually, no, it didn't. Because if his faith failed, when he started to go down, he wouldn't have said, "Lord, save me." He lost his focus, not his faith. It's fantastic. His faith actually never failed. It just got diverted. And a lot of time our doubt is not that we believe something wrong about God. We just forgotten about him completely. That's so powerful. Later on in the story, in Luke chapter 22, in the Last Supper, the Lord said to Simon, "Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked to have you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, and I have not prayed that you not be sifted. I prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." And then listen to the rest of the story, because later Jesus goes to the cross the next day. 3 days later, he rises from the dead. He's ascended, and he says, "Go tell the disciples and Peter," make sure Peter gets it, make sure his mouth isn't moving, "that I'll meet you in Galilee." They go to Galilee, they get up there, and Jesus isn't there. And so what do? They go out and they go fishing. There's the word. On the Sea of Galilee. And they fish all night and they catch nothing. That had happened 3 years before, too. And there's this guy standing on the shore. He says, "Guys, you caught anything?" Fishermen love it when they've caught any, haven't caught anything, and somebody asks them about it. "No." Let your nets down the other side. You know the whole story. You know, I'm pretty sure they'd tried both sides of the boat, the front of the boat, the back of the boat, tried everything all night long. That's what fishermen do. Suddenly the net's so full they can't pull it in. And John leans over to Peter and says, "Peter, you dim bulb, it's the Lord." What did Peter do? I love this. He jumped out of the boat. He jumped out of the boat. This time he swims to shore, because it isn't about walking on water. It isn't about the water at all. He said, "I trust you. And I want you." And sitting on the shore, Jesus asked him 3 times, just like he denied him 3 times. "Peter, do you love me?" "Yes." "Okay, Peter, I've prayed for you that your faith not fail. You go tend my lambs, feed my sheep, strengthen your brethren." I love that. "Lord, if it's you, I'm getting out of this stupid boat." And our trials stop often because we perceive the trial rather than the Lord. And then the perceived trial leads to the essential question in verse 31. "And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him, and he said to him, 'Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?'" This is not a slap in the face. Again, if you study the Gospels, you find that Jesus very often referred to his disciples this way. "Look, listen, little faith guys. Listen, spiritual midgets. You need to stop and ask yourself a question here. Why did you doubt? You know what the answer is? Because I can't handle this." And Jesus says, "Exactly. That's why you doubted. It became about you. It came about your power, your ability, your reasoning, your everything. I can't handle this." And he says, "But I am. And I can." See, that's the thing. It's not the lack of faith, it's the lack of focus. And the question is, why did you doubt? And if we're honest with ourselves, I could have had a Lord, not a V8. See, the answer is, you forgot who Jesus is. In chapter 8, you had learned, he is the master of the wind and the waves. Mark points out, and maybe it's because Mark wasn't there, but Mark points out in Mark 6:52, they had not yet understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened. Don't get down to people in the Bible who have hard hearts. You got one too. You got a hard heart and you got a soft head. You're resistant to the lessons God wants you to learn, and your brain's wide open to all kinds of baloney out there like it's a ghost. And for the first time, they recognized his deity and they worshiped him. "Ah! I got it! You are the Son of God. And you deserve my worship." Ladies and gentlemen, why do you doubt? Why? Because you forgot who Jesus is. That's why. You say, "But it's the wind." No, it's not the wind. You forgot who Jesus is. "It's the waves." It's not the waves. It's who Jesus is. "But I don't have a boat." It's not the boat. Jesus calls you out of the boat. You forgot who Jesus is. And so you doubt. Let's pray. Father, I pray this morning that you would reinforce in our hearts and minds just who Jesus is. That without him, we can do nothing, and we are so good at nothing that we're almost proud of it sometimes. Lord, we need to see Christ. We need to make our decisions based on Christ. We have to evaluate our situations based on Jesus Christ. But we're so convinced that we're on our own, and we're so unwilling to let you be God rather than what we have declared you to be, that we forget that Jesus is Jesus. And when we're rowing our hearts out, he's just taking a stroll. When we're sure that something is impossible, he casually says, "Hey, come do it." We doubt because we've forgotten Jesus. It's not how much faith we got. It's who we've put it in. May we trust in him today. I pray in Christ Jesus' precious name. Amen.